121 is a special edition of the self-hosted podcast because we're recording this before Alex and I get together at Texas Linux Fest, which is where it all began.
Oh, Alex. Yeah, geez, yeah, it is. It's one of those time travel episodes where we're recording like a week and a half early. Yeah. Texas Linux Fest, when was that? Must have been 2018, I guess.
Before times. Yeah, I can't really recall quite, but that was really what kicked it all off.
I was still a full Brit back then.
Yes, but I think it was the delicious barbecue that made you decide to really stay.
Oh, no doubt.
Now, before we get to our special guest this week, it looks like you got yourself a little piece of hardware, an HDMI extender, but it's an HDMI extender over Ethernet.
Yes. Now, I've for many years been familiar with the Bullun extenders, which let you extend HDMI over a single or a pair of Cat5e cables. In fact, when I was a student, I used to put my gaming desktop under the stairs in my student house and run a couple of Ethernet cables up the stairs to my display in my bedroom. And that worked fine. But, you know, I'm a little bit past that these days, and I want high-speed input devices for my actual gaming machine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I ended up not going that route. But I have in front of me here the TES Smart, or TE Smart, because there's one too few S's for it to be TES Smart. The model number is the HKE12MMA20-RX. And there's a dash TX as well. And what this does is it broadcasts a 1080p 60Hz HDMI signal just over your bog standard IP-based network. So I can plug this into any UniFi or any Ethernet switch in the house. So I've got the transmitter in the basement, and then up here in my bonus room, which is like a good 300 feet away as the fiber flies, I have the receiver, and it outputs 1080p as if I was sat in the same spot.
So it must be encoding it and sending it over IP?
Oh, yeah, you can definitely tell. Like when you look closely at text, you know, you can spot compression artifacts and things. Like YouTube videos work totally flawlessly. The frame rate's great, 60 hertz. Like there's no drop frames or anything like that. But if you look closely at static images like text and things, like you can definitely tell it's not quite as sharp. But I mean, for what this is doing, I've actually just put a splitter onto my HDMI KVM switch that I've got down in my server rack down in the basement. So I've got one output going to the Pi KVM. And then as a backup, I've got this going out to the monitor behind me on my desk, which doesn't need a web browser. It doesn't need Pi KVM to be up or whatever. And it does USB HID device pass-through. So I can connect a keyboard and mouse to this receiver, and it can tune into any one of up to 16 different channels. So I could actually have 16 different transmitters and up to, I think, 200 and something different receivers tuned into different channels. So, you know, in the old days, this would have been suitable for like a TiVo box, and then you tune it into multiple different rooms, that kind of thing.
That is really cool. For a very brief period of time, One of my all-time best setups was I had a KVM console at my cubicle desk, so I could just turn around and actually work at the console of the server. And man, was that so great.
Yeah.
I love what you're putting down right now. Like I could put one of these on each one of the servers, although I don't think any of them do HDMI out. But in theory, if they did, I could put one of these on each one of the servers, have one receiver in my office, and then I could just toggle between them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's cool.
The only downside would be that each unit is about $60 or $70.
That seems fair, though, for what it's doing.
Yeah, yeah. It feels about right to me, to be honest. If it was at the sort of $30, $40 price point, then it would just be total no-brainer. But with it being $70, it's kind of at that, I just need to think twice territory. But
how does it handle like the post process when the machine's booting up and the resolution is flickering and changing? Any weirdness with any of that stuff so far?
Well, I've only tested it with my Blue Iris box, which is running Windows, and it's in an HP 290 Slim, and it seems to handle that just fine. I haven't actually gone into the BIOS, so maybe I will try that, and if there's any issues, I'll report back. But so far, so good with this thing. You know, I left it on for 24 hours just as a test, the monitor behind me, and worked perfectly.
Well, I think you're spending my money again, Alex. I kind of want one of those. Just try to grab a link from you.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome to the show Casey Liss. You may well know him from Accidental Tech Podcast, or ATP, if that's your preference. Welcome to the show, Casey.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
We're on video talking to you today, and this is one of those moments where I've listened to you for so many years, and now I see you talking. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, it messes up your mind. I've been there. I've been on the other side of this, and it is very, very odd. So I almost said awkward, but I don't know if awkward is the right word for it. That's also very negative. It's just unusual. And plus, in all likelihood, I probably sound drunk because I'm talking slower than, you know, the 3X that everyone seems to listen to podcasts in. And so I sound like, you know, I'm talking so incredibly slowly as compared to normal. So I totally understand.
I'm a 1Xer myself. I just, I can't do it. I can't do it. It feels like I'm on too many caffeine shots for the day.
Gives you anxiety, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
Casey, I knew what you looked like because I've been following you on social media for a bit. And so I also have been following that you got an Apple Vision Pro. So later on in the show, we'll be talking to you about that. Mm-hmm. But towards the beginning, we thought we should probably stay on topic and talk a little self-hosting. And if anybody's listened to ATP, they know that you are really our brother and kin there when it comes to self-hosting, because I've heard you mention things like garage door sensor automations and Raspberry Pis. So I think that's probably where we should start, Alex.
Yes, sir. So talk us through a little bit what you've got running in the house, Casey. I know that typically with ATP, it's Apple focused, but like Chris just said, you've got a bunch of stuff running locally. Are you a home assistant guy or...
You're starting off tough. I see how it is. I thought this was going to be friendly. So I tried Home Assistant years ago. This was easily like 3, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And at the time, the way it thought and the way I thought were just polar opposites. It doesn't mean Home Assistant was bad or wrong or anything like that. It's just, I could not wrap my head around it. And I think it's because what I went into Home Assistant wanting was, I just want a bridge to get non-HomeKit stuff into HomeKit. And so you can guess where this is going. I quickly realized this was not for me. And so what I need is just HomeBridge. And I've been running HomeBridge for forever. And in fact, HomeBridge and Pi-hole were the two things that got me started on doing any sort of home lab sort of thing. I don't recall which came first. It was possibly HomeBridge, but I don't have a strong memory one way or the other. But I wanted to do, you know, I wanted to get stuff on HomeKit. And so I started running HomeBridge. And if memory serves, I've always run HomeBridge and Docker. So that was my first adventure into containerization and things of that nature. My professional background is I did a lot of web development for a long time, but I got out of that right around the time like Docker and Kubernetes and all that sort of thing started coming up. And so I never really had an excuse to learn any of it. And then I moved to iOS development and podcasting and whatnot. And so, again, I haven't really had a lot of excuses to do that sort of thing. But I taught myself how to at least be dangerous with Docker. And I was running, and am running HomeBridge. And then Pi-hole, I started also in Docker. And we can talk about where this was all happening. But anyways, that started in Docker. Actually, that's a perfect segue, come to think of it, because I was running all this on an old Synology, DS1813+. I'm a huge Synology super fan. And that machine, I very well could have been user error, but it did not cooperate well with IPv6. And this was you know, 4 or 5 years ago now, 3 or 4 years ago, where IPv6 was really starting to become an actual thing rather than a hypothetical thing. And so maybe in theory. And so anyway, so I moved the Pi-hole onto a dedicated Raspberry Pi 3B, I think. I might have that wrong. But I got a Raspberry Pi right before nobody could get a Raspberry Pi, because this was like shortly pre-pandemic. And that's running, you know, raw on the metal there. And then over time, I started realizing, well, this Docker thing works out real well. I can put other stuff in there. Although I don't run Plex or Channels, which I'm a super fan of both of those, in a container. I do run both of those on a Mac Mini that I have in the house. I have the Raspberry Pi running Pi-hole, and I was running Pi VPN. And then I found that I was having a little bit of problems with WireGuard. And I thought, man, if only there was a way to do WireGuard easily. And I discovered this thing. I don't know if either of you have heard of it. It's called Tailscale, and it's really good. You should check it out sometime.
Have you ever seen QI? Because I feel like at the moment, the klaxons would be going off behind us.
I know, right?
Yeah. I was not put up for that. I was not put up to say any of that for the rest of
the time. Well done.
It just comes up naturally sometimes.
So the Pi still remains in service running Pi-hole?
It does. It's running Pi-hole, and a couple, like when I need to do a cron job for something silly, that's typically where I'll do it, because, you know, why not? I upgraded my Synology to, shoot, what is that? It's a 6-bay from 2021. So what is that? A DS something 621. I forget the name or the model off the top of my head. I'm very embarrassed now. But anyways, it's a 6-bay instead of an 8-bay, because I, you know, hard drives have gotten bigger and it's quite a bit more powerful. This is before Synology got real aggressive about using Synology branded hard drives, which I really don't love.
Boo hiss.
Yeah, I don't like that at all. I'm a Synology super fan, with an asterisk because I really don't love that whole thing. And so I'm running a bunch of containers on there. But to come back to Home Assistant, I feel like I need a Home Assistant like guide, because like not in, as in terms of text. I mean, I need someone to like hold my hand and show me this is the way, because everyone I speak to who's ever run Home Assistant swears by it. I was actually just earlier today, not in prep for the show. I swear this is organic. I was watching one of Alex's videos with regard to tail scale and reverse proxies and something else, but it involved Home Assistant doing things that Home Assistant, in my opinion, had no business doing, but yet it did it really, really well. It was something with reverse proxies and whatnot. I think it was the most recent video on YouTube as we speak. But one way or the other, I feel like Home Assistant would be my kind of crap. I just haven't had it click yet. So somebody needs to come and hold my hand and show me the way.
Home Assistant's really interesting because it can be... So if you're running Home Assistant OS, you can use it like a platform to run other self-hosted applications. Like it has an app store.
Oh, wow.
There's lots of other things in this space that do a similar job, like CAS OS. There's Umbral 2. Mm-hmm. Unraid, of course, is the MVP in the original sort of self-hosted app store, NAS type situation. Synology, of course, does it too. But what's interesting about Home Assistant is that it's all open source and all the add-ons are community maintained and all the rest of it. Like even the Tailscale add-on in Home Assistant is actually maintained by Frank, who's one of the core developers of Home Assistant.
That's super cool.
So Tailscale doesn't actually touch it. Mm-hmm. Although we do work with Frank sometimes.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I'd also like to know, Casey, what you use Homebridge for today, because it feels like maybe that's solving 90% of your use cases right now.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't do a whole bunch of advanced stuff with Homebridge specifically. And so generally speaking, Homebridge is just get me something like a Wemo device onto Homebridge. Actually, I have a physical bridge for that, come to think of it, but that's sort of a thing. You know, get me something that isn't on...
So lights, audio. Yeah.
And actually, this is a good segue. I don't know if it was intentional. I'll believe it was. It was a good segue into my bananas garage door setup, which is, you know, early in 2020... everyone's locked at home. I needed a pandemic project. And I thought, you know what I can do? I can figure out a way to detect whether or not my garage door is open. So at bedtime, I won't leave it open. And any normal human would have done like a Chamberlain MyQ, which I had used at some point. And I forget why I stopped using it, but this was before it kind of got cruddy.
Probably because whenever you want to close that door, it does that annoying like 5 second wait and then blinks at you 8 million times. Like, are you sure you like, yeah, just close the damn door thing. Come on.
Just close the door. I said close the door. Just close the door.
Yes.
So anyway, so I decided that the only reasonable way to detect whether or not your garage door was open, this clearly there's no simpler way to do this, is to get two Raspberry Pi 0Ws. So Wi-Fi enabled Raspberry Pis, WHs strictly speaking, because it had the header pins already soldered to it. And I put one down above the garage door with, I forget the name of the thing, but a sensor where if there's two panels, like two little contacts next to each other, it's either open or closed, depending on how you buy it.
Magnetic reed switch?
Yes, a reed switch might be it. Yeah, I think you're right. I can never remember the darn name of it. But anyways, so you have these two things, and I have one at the top of the garage door and one, you know, right on the frame of the house. And when they're, you know, physically close to each other, then the circuit is either closed or open. I forget off the top of my head. And so this 0W is via, you know, the Raspberry Pi GPIO is reading the state of that switch. And then it's periodically broadcasting via UDP. Okay, the garage is open, the garage is closed, so on and so forth. And that was fine. And then I had a different Pi 0W, even though they're separated literally by the floor of the primary bedroom and nothing else. I could have run a wire if I really felt like it. But why would you do that when UDP exists? And so I had a second Pi 0WH up in the bedroom, and that is wired to an LED, and it slurps up these UDP broadcasts and says, oh, the garage door's open, light up the LED. And so the LED, the red LED, is illuminated when the garage door is open, and then it is turned off when the garage door is closed. And then I thought, well, hell, if I've already got this in Home Assistant, why not run a web server? And a web server can ping that same garage door Raspberry Pi, and then you can run in Homebridge. This is what made me think of it. In Homebridge, you can have a accessory that acts as garage door and just makes HTTP requests. And I'm sure that Home Assistant could do the same thing. I don't think any of this is particularly advanced or novel, but that was, I was using the tools in front of me. And so now I have this cockamamie setup where I have the garage door Raspberry Pi just detecting whether the garage door is open or not and broadcasting UDP signals and running a web server. Then I have the primary bedroom Raspberry Pi slurping up the UDP and illuminating an LED. And then I also have Homebridge running in a Docker container on the Synology because it isn't confusing enough yet. And that's pinging away at the garage door Raspberry Pi constantly asking, is the garage door up? Is the garage door up? Is the garage door up? And then notifying Homebridge, or I guess Homebridge, strictly speaking, is doing the pinging, and it is letting me know whether or not the garage door is open. Oh, and then just to really beat this horse completely into the afterlife, I decided, you know what? I really am concerned about the physical security of my garage door for reasons, even though I live in like a completely vanilla suburb of Richmond, Virginia, nevertheless. And so there's this app on the Mac called Swift Bar, which is like a reincarnation of Bitbar. What that lets you do is put stuff on the menu bar up on the top of the Mac screen. This is kind of like the, what was it, the bottom right of Windows? I can't remember the name.
Sys Tray.
Yeah, thank you. And so you can put custom stuff up there. And so now I have a little bespoke garage door icon sitting on the top of my screen, letting me know if the garage door is open or closed. Like it literally has like the frame of the garage door when it's open and it's empty. And then it has the frame of the garage door with the garage door in it when the garage door is closed. So I will always flip and know if my garage door is open one way or the other. It is bananas.
I'd say that definitely makes you a home assistant guy. Yeah, I think that...
That's the thing, is I feel like this probably could have been accomplished way easier in home assistant. Now, no regrets, because I needed something to do with my darn hands during the early days of the pandemic. But I will be the first to tell you, this is a banana setup that is probably 8 times more complicated than I needed it to be.
I hope you filed a patent with Rube Goldberg before you set that up.
I should have. I should have looked into that. You're exactly right.
You know, what's interesting is there's a project in Home Assistant, which maybe if this Raspberry Pi thing ever, one of those many things ever goes sideways, you might want to look into. ESP Home will do the trick for you as well. So you define in YAML a small piece of configuration. It spits out an ESP8266 firmware bin file. You flash that onto the device. And it will read the pinouts of read switches and
Super cool.
All sorts of stuff. So yeah, just take a look. ESP Home, you might find it useful.
I should do that. That's the thing, is I need you to just come, you know, what are you, three and a half hours apart. I just need you to come visit and like hold my hand and show me the way when it comes to Home Assistant, because I feel like I'm a stiff breeze away.
That just there was a beautiful moment for me as a Brit living in America. So the British audience right now will be appreciating that Casey just hand waved a 3.5 hour drive away as if it's nothing.
Yeah, it is nothing.
What? In England, that's like a weekend trip. You've got to pack all sorts of snacks in the car. And right. It's a big deal. So.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I'm in the suburbs of Richmond, right? And the downtown Richmond is, on a bad day, half an hour away, maybe. And it's funny because I didn't grow up here. I moved here after college. I'm sorry, Alex, university. And so I came after college, and I'm in like, you know, the yuppie area of Richmond. And Erin, my wife, makes merciless fun of me. She grew up here, makes merciless fun of me for how beleaguered I am, or aggrieved I am, when she asks to do something downtown. Oh, do we have, it's so far. It's 20 minutes, y'all, 20 minutes. It's so far. Do we really, why can't we just stay around here? I don't know what my issue is, but I will complain and moan for an hour about a 20 minute drive. And yes, you're exactly right. I will literally wave my hand and say 3.5 hours is nothing.
Well, when I lived in London, it was always, so I've got this theory that like cities have this time. So in Raleigh, everywhere is 15 or 20 minutes away from everywhere else. In London, it was an hour. It didn't matter where you went, it was always an hour. So Richmond's time is clearly 20 minutes.
Yep, about, roughly. Unless you're going to an extreme end. But yes, your point is completely fair, completely noted, and completely accurate.
Now, on your rundown there, Casey, there was one thing you said that I wanted to kind of dig into a little bit more. And you mentioned, and I've heard you mention this on your show too, that you're running Plex on a Mac Mini. Could you go into more detail there? Is this a headless Mac Mini? Is it connecting to the Synology storage through a network storage share somehow?
Yeah, everyone knows that person with like 85,000 movies in Plex, right? And so my media collection is not 85,000 movies, but actually I can tell you by way of my fancy Get homepage, which is another package I run on Docker, I have, 1,311 movies and 125 TV shows, which is not insignificant, but I mean, I am Plex pals, if you will, with people that have like literally 10 times the amount of media I have. So anyway, I take it seriously enough, and I share with enough friends and family that I want to be able to transcode stuff and do that without having to stress about it. not that I'm running, you know, my own personal private Netflix. It's just, if I'm somewhere else and I want to be able to transcode something, I want to be able to freaking transcode something. I have two small children. And although they are very good children and very patient, they do not love it when there's a media related problem with my infrastructure. And so
it doesn't feel good as a dad either.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not happy as a dad. You're not happy.
Yeah, I'm not happy. Everything, you know, my wife's looking at me like, this is your thing. What, how did you get this wrong? But I'm painting her as though she's mean. She's wonderful. But anyway, so the point is, I wanted to be able to transcode well. And I started this journey, I believe I was running Plex as an app, to Alex's point earlier, as an app on the old Synology. And it was all well and good until transcoding was required. And then it just coughed all over itself. Mm-hmm. And that quickly became untenable. And so at this point, I was running an iMac Pro as my primary machine. And so I moved Plex to be on there. But I didn't absolutely love Plex living on my primary computer. And so then I thought, okay, well, what can I do here? At the same time, a friend of mine who works at Mac Stadium, they're a Mac Mini colocation place. And so you can literally grab a Mac Mini and either send it to them or they can, you know, buy one on your behalf and load it into their, I think it's a Las Vegas data center. And they had an old Intel Mac Mini that they were literally just going to throw away. And he was like, hey, I'll send it to you if you want. And that became my Plex server for a while. And then the Apple Silicon transition happened and I was like, well, I don't want this old and creaky Intel thing in my house. I'm too good for this. Excuse me. Thank you very much. And so I got a refurb M1 Mac Mini and that's running Plex, which everyone is probably familiar with, and Channels, which I don't know how much you fellas know about this, but Channels is a really incredible app for a very specific set of problems. So I believe the website is getchannels.com, if I'm not mistaken. And Channels, it's basically a network or a replacement, a software DVR, which in and of itself doesn't sound that remarkable. But what's really great about Channels is that it has incredible support for HD Home Run, which is a physical device that you can either hook up to an antenna so you can get like over the air broadcasts, or what I've eventually graduated to is you can get a cable card, which is a thing still to this day. I swear. Wow. It's a thing. And they are PCMCIA cards, or if not literally, then they look just like them. And that's an acronym you haven't heard in 15, 20 years. But anyways, you can get a cable card and hook it up to a particular kind of HD Home Run, and Channels will slurp up and record TV shows right off of your cable connection. And that's what I do. You know, we have Verizon Fios here in Richmond, and I have a coax line running to my left as I sit here in the office. I have a coax line running into the HD Home Run with a cable card in it. And that's how we record stuff. And the Channels becomes my DVR. And then if things are something that I think is worth keeping, then I'll, you know, slurp that into Final Cut Pro, take out the commercials, and that'll eventually graduate to Plex as long-term, like forever storage. And so both of those things run on the Mac Mini. The Mac Mini is probably overkill for that purpose. But I find that I don't particularly have the interest in maintaining anything but Linux or Mac OS. And so I don't really want a Windows box. That's not to say there's anything wrong with them. And I know like a NUC is probably the right answer here, to be honest, but I don't want it. And so I got the Mac Mini because it's the path of least resistance for me. And it's worked out really well, if a bit overkill.
Well, you say a NUC is the right move. I mean, there are these little Dell small form factor things you can get that are actually just slightly smaller than a Mac Mini. Not much, granted. They've got an Intel chip in them. I'm sorry to deal with your sensitivities, but they have some hardware transcoding built into them called QuickSync. And it's a really powerful drug if you're running Plex or Jellyfin or any kind of DVR system, because the hardware transcoder in these boxes sips power. We're talking sort of 4, 5, 6 watts to do a 4K transcode. One question I have for you, Casey, about running Plex on a Mac Mini particularly, does it take advantage of any of the hardware acceleration in the M1 chip to do video decoding?
You're asking a completely reasonable question to which I'm not 100% sure the answer. I think it does. I very well may be lying to you accidentally, but I think it does. I don't know if it did early on, but I thought at some point that landed. I again, Plex super fan. I know that they're Jelly, or what was it, Jellyfin, and what's the other one? Ember or something like that?
MB. Yeah.
MB, thank you. I know that they're super fans of those as well. I'm not here to say that Plex is, you know, the one true way, but Plex can be a little slow on the uptake for some of these sorts of things. Like they were very slow on HDR support, for example, but I thought that they had it. And certainly I've had like 4 and 5 simultaneous streams running on Plex on this Mac Mini. And it seemed fine. And some of those were direct for sure. And some of them were transcodes, and it's worked out okay. It's funny you bringing up like wattage and stuff, because I never really cared about that in the past, but my new favorite toy is you can get these, and this isn't exactly what you're talking about, but you can get these USB-C cables that like have little watt meters in them. And I really wish I didn't know this existed, because now I want, I have yes. feeling like everywhere. And I'm like, oh, well, why is my iPad not charging fast enough? It's only using 15 watts instead of 20. What's going on?
Yeah.
And it's like the same reason I don't put battery percentages on my devices, because it just adds stress. And yet here I am constantly buying these damn things on Amazon because I'm addicted to knowing how much power I'm using. It's a problem.
Those are pretty great.
How do you remotely manage a Mac then? I mean, I know you can do like screen sharing and stuff like that, but is it a good SSH platform? Like talk us through that a bit.
It's a great SSH platform. I can't remember if Tailscale SSH supports the Mac. I know it doesn't. I know the Synology is wonky and that doesn't work, which
it does not, to my knowledge.
Yeah. Okay. So I should really talk to somebody that works at Tailscale, if only I knew anyone, and see if we could get that yeah. Bumped right up the priority list.
Got one word for you, Casey: sandboxing.
Yeah, I know. And that's completely fair. And you're not wrong. In all seriousness, it is a pretty good SSH, you know, platform. I don't have dramatic needs of the device. You know, generally speaking, if it's working, it's working. That's all I care about. But I SSH into it. Apple devices, or the Mac devices, have... They call it screen sharing, but ultimately it's just VNC under the hood, and that's all built in. And so you just have to flip it on, and you can VNC. And actually, as of just a few months before the Vision Pro landed, when they added this Mac virtual display thing, now you have like this super high quality version of VNC that I think is proprietary to Apple platforms. And you could, I wouldn't, but you could watch a video like on the remote screen through VNC. Like it's phenomenal how good it is if you really wanted to. So that's what I do.
I've just thought that's now the reason for you to buy a Vision Pro, so you can remotely administer your servers.
that's definitely worth $3,500. That's what it is. But no, I mean, it does work, and it's surprising how well it works. I will say that it is running headless, and it used to be, and I just have always had this plugged in. I don't know if it's still the case, but it used to be that you needed to get one of those dumb HDMI little things that you stick in so it feels like the machine thinks it has a monitor plugged in, even though it doesn't. There's a term for this that I also is escaping me, but it's like 10 or 15 bucks on Amazon.
A dummy plug, I think.
Yeah. And I plugged one of those in on the Intel Mac Mini, and I genuinely don't know if it's required these days, but it was. Oh, I'm doing a thumbs up on the video here because Apple is so great. So anyways, I don't know if it's required today, but it certainly was back in the Intel days, and I've been running one of those, and that's fine. And it's this way it always runs effectively a 4K display, and that's what I'm VNCing into. And it, again, as long as I'm on a moderately decent network connection, it's fine. And when I'm at home, it's as though I'm looking at the physical monitor. It's impressive.
I don't know if this was in honor of Casey's pre-arrival this week or not, but something in my mind just went, Alex, you've got to do this and just try it out. Just in the name of science, I went and bought a Vision Pro this week.
In the name of science, of course.
In the name of science. I mean, how could you not? It's so affordable.
Yeah.
There's so many clear use cases for it. How could you not?
As you know, Casey, he has to for his podcast job. He has to. Yeah.
I've heard that excuse works from time to time.
And remote server administration, as we just established.
Mm-hmm.
Blink SSH in that thing is obviously the only use case that makes sense.
Right, right.
I mean, obviously, Chris and I, as you listen to this, we've already been in Texas, but we're about to go to Texas, so I've got a flight coming up, and I'm like, well, I really want to try Vision Pro on a plane and see how that whole thing goes.
You have to be that guy. You do. You just have to embrace it. So I have not been on a plane with it, although I literally 2 weeks from today as we record, I'm going to be traveling to Memphis. And I plan to be that guy, although I'm talking a big game. We'll see if I actually come through. But no, I did use it on the train when I visited a friend of mine, a co-host of mine, Mike Hurley, who happened to be in New York for his Vision Pro pickup because he's a Londoner, can't get it in London yet. And so he flew into New York and picked his up there. And I thought, well, you know, it's not often that I can say that Mike is on the Eastern Seaboard. So I took the train, the Amtrak, up to New York City, and I used it on the train, and I did get a couple of weird looks, but surprisingly, most people just did not care.
Yeah.
And now again, this is a train, which is a very different animal than a plane. It's a lot more space, a lot fewer people, but it was incredible. And to kind of jump right into the deep end with it, in a situation where I'm used to my normal operating procedures. I sit here right now. I have three 5K displays in front of me. I have a LG Ultrafine that was sent to me by one of my podcast co-hosts because he hates this thing. And I like it. So he just wanted it out of his house. And I said, okay, sure, I'll take it. And so there's an LG Ultrafine to my left. There's a studio display in front of me. And then there's an LG Ultrafine that I bought secondhand a few years ago to my right. So I have 15 Ks, if you will, of displays all around me. I probably am getting a suntan as we speak, even though it's nighttime. And so because of that, that's all well and good when you're at home, but when you travel, it's crappy because I'm used to infinite real estate and now I have effectively none. I use a 13-inch MacBook Pro. I made that choice deliberately, but it's not great. And if you're trying to get anything productive done, you want to have more real estate. And I recently, like a year ago, I got a little, I think it's a 2K 13-inch portable display that runs on USB-C. It's like bus powered, the whole rigmarole. I love this thing. It's not great, but it was like $150 and I love it. But then the Vision Pro came and it turns out one of the things you can do with the Vision Pro is what they call Mac Virtual Display, which is you can suck your Mac screen into the Vision OS virtual world. And what's really trick about it is if you have your Mac laptop in front of you, and if it's open, you know, as you would expect, you're not clamshelled or anything, you can literally just look at your laptop and then a little Kinect button floats up above it and you just pinch on the Kinect button and then suddenly you're looking at your Mac screen in the virtual world and your Mac screen is now black. So you could be doing bills. You could be doing, you know, top secret proprietary work stuff and no one will know because the only people that can see it are your two eyeballs inside the Vision Pro. It is incredibly cool. And of all the things that I've used the Vision Pro for, I think that might be the, maybe not the coolest, but the most important to me because in the occasion I want it, I really want it, like in a hotel room or something, or on a plane or on a train. I really want that real estate. And there's no other way to get it when you're in a car, you know, when you're in a moving vehicle. And even in a hotel room, you're not going to bring a 5K display to a hotel. Like that's just, I'm not going to be that guy. So
you're not Marques Brownlee carrying an iMac across the country.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. With my Pelican case and the whole rigmarole. Exactly. So that in and of itself is so cool.
But it is only one screen. Is that not a problem for you still?
You know, I can't tell if you're snarking, but it is a reasonable question. And I don't love that aspect of it. But I mean, it was not that long ago that, I was rocking the iMac Pro. And that was one 5K display. And somehow I was able to work with that for like 3 years. So I can, right. I feel like I can go back to that and be okay.
Yeah, it's still better than a 13-inch screen.
Exactly.
So what I'll say in counter to that, Chris, is, well, first of all, there is an app that I think it's in test flight, or maybe it just came out, called Split Screen, which lets you do multiple displays. I found it a little buggy, a little rough around the edges. It kind of works. But you've got your Mac display, and then wherever your eyes look, the keyboard and mouse, you sort of realize using this Vision Pro, all of the little things Apple have added over the last 5 years to iOS and like handoff and, you know, some of the MagSafe improvements and all these other things, right? You realize that they have been sucked out of the Vision Pro and thrust upon the masses. So I've got my Mac display mirrored in front of me. I look up to my right and I've got a YouTube window in Safari on VisionOS Safari playing. And suddenly my keyboard and mouse is in that window. I don't have to do anything. It's just where I'm looking. And there was an early ATP episode that you guys did where you were talking about how some of the UI paradigms where you have to get used to looking and clicking at the same time, exactly what, you know, pinching on what you want.
Yeah.
Turns out you were spot on with that because there's a number of times where my eyes, I realize using a real computer, I don't mean the Vision OS isn't a real computer.
No, I'm with you.
But like using an old computer where I realize I'm clicking on stuff and my eyes are already 5 seconds ahead on the next thing where that UI element is going to be. And in the Vision Pro, you can't do that.
Right. And that's the thing is, you know, being a good typist, a good touch typer is amazing until it isn't. And this is one of those cases where like I might be looking and typing like a search query in the Safari, you know, a search bar. But yet I'm also looking over to the other direction because I'm watching a YouTube video or what have you. And with the Vision Pro, your gaze is also your pointer. And that's both magical and freaking terrible, depending on the context, yes. Which is kind of funny. But so when did you pick yours up? Just this week, you said?
Yeah, I went on Friday. And as we record, it's Tuesday. So I had a demo on Friday and I told the guy in the store, I'm not going to buy it. Went home. I said to my wife, I didn't buy one. Look, aren't I a good boy? And she went, oh, I was looking forward to playing with that. So I was like, right,
gotta go.
No, really?
Yeah, literally. And I booked her a demo for the next day, so and she had one, and we picked one up. So I spent most of the weekend in it, and I've got a 65-inch OLED TV on the wall behind me here, and it feels small now I'm out of the Vision Pro because I've suddenly got used to 120-inch video screens. Aren't the immersive videos, I want to talk to you a little bit about like content and stuff like that. Like I found a couple of apps that let you stream Plex into this thing. They're still very early days. Like the immersive mode is limited to certain streaming services like Apple TV and Disney Plus, for example, have what's called immersive mode, where it puts you in like the seat of an actual theater, for example. But I found one called Cinephile for Plex that lets you do a similar thing for Plex. It's not as polished as all the others, but it does the job. So I'm really looking forward to on the plane a bit of that.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that the problem with the Vision Pro is that you really, really, really need to experience it. And if you live anywhere near an Apple store, which depending on your portion of the country or the world, that may or may not be an easy ask. But, you know, we have one Apple store in Richmond and that's it. And we're the nearest Apple store for like 2 to 3 hours drive in many different directions, which is kind of barbaric. But here we are. But thankfully, it's only like 20 minutes from my house. So there you go. Coming full circle now. But nonetheless, if you have the time, book yourself a Vision Pro demo. Even if you do not care about Apple, if you don't care about the Vision Pro, if you don't care about any of this, it is worth the, what is it, like half an hour of your time, leaving aside the travel and whatnot. It's worth half an hour of your time just to experience it, because there is no way for me to verbalize what this is like. And, you know, I was struggling on the most recent episode as we record of ATP because one of my co-hosts, John, who is annoyingly bright and annoyingly good at so many things. But I was trying to verbalize to him, like, look, there's a big difference between 3D, which is what we're used to, right? Where you have a rectangle, but that rectangle has depth to it. There is a big difference between 3D and what Apple calls immersive. Because with 3D, there's a rectangle and there's depth, and that's cool. But with immersive, you can turn your head to look at something else. And that just completely changes everything.
That Alicia Keys demo, right? Where you've got, so they've got this thing called Alicia Keys Rehearsal Room. And it basically, they've got four cameras dotted throughout the room. And you're in a small, it can't be more than sort of a few hundred square feet little rehearsal room with Alicia Keys and her band. And you can sit there, and as a musician and a drummer, like, I love just watching. If I could go for a Blu-ray that is literally just focused on Danny Carey in Tool the whole time, like, that's what I would do.
Right.
But unfortunately, such things rarely exist until the immersive music concerts come out. And it's really something. Like, you think, oh, the bass player is doing something interesting, I'm going to watch the bass player for a second.
Exactly. So I cannot play anything but a stereo, and even that I can only play with some amount of efficiency. I have never been a musician. I wish I was. I wish so desperately I was. I am terrible. But I love music. I love watching concert films. I love NPR Tiny Desk. You know, I love MTV Unplugged.
You didn't mention Phish. I'm surprised.
trigger warning, please. Trigger warning. But nevertheless, and I love so much. Like, I have an entire library on Plex dedicated to Dave Matthews Band concerts because I'm one of those. You know, I went to school and I went to college in the early 2000s. This is what we did. But anyways, I loved the Alicia Keys thing for exactly what you're describing, that I might be interested in the guitarist or the bassist or the drummer or what have you, but the director might be focused on Alicia Keys, which on the surface makes sense. But the great thing is, I can turn my head and look at what I want to look at. Now, granted, that bassist may be on the other side of the room from the particular camera that I'm looking through right now. I shouldn't say camera, because that implies like a stationary static thing. But you know what I mean? Like, you know, the perspective that I have right now is from the other side of the room. But at least I can turn my head and watch that this bass player is freaking shredding over there. And, you know, in any normal scenario, I'd just be looking at Alicia Keys being Alicia Keys, which is phenomenal. But I wanted to see the bass player. Now I can. And actually, there's an app that I just got wind of. Shoot, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find what the name of it is offhand, but it's an app that's specifically for immersive concerts. And it's all of the concerts are, I think, $13 each, but they have a demo of somebody. I could be that guy and put this all on my head as we record and figure it out, but I won't. But they have a demo of somebody that I downloaded, but I haven't had a chance to watch as we record. But apparently these are like short, like Alicia Keys length concerts where you can buy them and they're immersive. You can look around and so on and so forth. I know T-Pain was on there. I think Megan Thee Stallion or whatever she's called. I'm so old and I don't know what the correct pronunciation for any of these people are. But I think there was one of hers. And then there's the demo one and like somebody else I was not aware of. And I haven't had a chance to watch it. And if I remember, or please, gentlemen, remind me, and I'm happy to send you a link to whatever it is this thing is called, because again, I can't remember it offhand. But I would kill for this. Like, for whatever your particular band is, I would pay all of the money to have an immersive concert. Like, it's that much better than 3D. And 3D is arguably, especially when you have a good situation where you don't have it dimming each eyeball in order to fake 3D. Like, in the Vision Pro, 3D is really good. But even still, immersive is just night and day better.
So I feel like there has been no device come out since the iPhone that has been so clearly the future of where computing, personal computing, is going. And yet this is such a hilariously first generation device in so many ways.
Yep.
But in contrast to that, like we're waxing lyrical about, like it's genuinely, you sort of put it on and you're like, this is it. They've solved it with the pinching, with the interfacing, with all of the, you know, Apple magic of handing off things to each other. And I don't know what you feel about like the next decade or so is going to look like with this device and this platform. But for me, I'm excited. Like, my daughter's 3 right now. By the time she's 13, I think these are going to be as ubiquitous as laptops in coffee shops.
You know, I think it's very possible. And the other interesting thing about having a 3-year-old is that now is the time, assuming your daily driver is an iPhone, now is the time to start recording immersive video. Like, I wouldn't do it always by any means, but iPhones, or at least iPhones Pro, the way they have their lenses on, maybe it's only the brand new ones, I forget now, but the way the lenses are situated is that it'll use the two lenses that are vertically, if you're holding a portrait, but they make you turn it horizontally so that they're adjacent to each other when you record. And it will, you can put the iPhone into this immersive video mode and you can record a 3D video. It's not stellar, but it is stunning. Like, it's funny because I know that sounds contradictory, which it kind of is, but the fidelity is all right. You kind of have like just a square that you're looking at this through, but there's a depth to it. And the spatial audio, which sounds 3D, or, you know, the surround sound, if you will, it just adds this unbelievable amount of figurative depth to what you're viewing. Similarly with like panoramas. Panoramas are one of my favorite things to look at in the Vision Pro, because generally speaking, a panorama, you know, it looks wonky. No matter what you do, it looks wonky when you're looking at it on a flat screen. And the Vision Pro isn't the first thing to do this, but when you have it kind of unravel or unwrap the panorama so it is panoramic, mm-hmm. it's like standing there. We have a photo I took 2-3 years ago of my family at a beach called Cape Charles on the eastern shore of Virginia. And, you know, I was standing probably 30 yards away from the family, and there's my wife, my son and daughter, and our dog over there to the side. And I look around at this panorama. No, nothing's moving. You know, it's dead still, no audio. And it's like I'm freaking there. It's just unreal how cool some of this stuff is. And so to build on what you're saying, Alex, like, today the hardware is phenomenal, except it's heavy and clunky and hot. The software is phenomenal, except it's a little wonky in a lot of places and a lot of things don't work and not a lot of apps have been written for the device. But yet you can see so easily where the future could go. And it's funny because early on, I was one of the many people that said, this is definitely going to be glasses one day. It's going to be AR glasses, and that's going to be the future. And the more time I spend in the Vision Pro, the less and less I think I was right about that. And the more I think that the immersion might be the thing that really sells it. And that's tough, because then you're immersed in this other world and you're not in your surroundings. You're ignoring your family. You're ignoring everything around you. And that's why they have that goofy looking display on the front and so on and so forth. But yeah. If you can be selfish for a minute, which I'm uniquely talented at, if you can be selfish for a minute, it is unlike anything else I've experienced. And it is very easy, if you're listening to this, particularly if you're not an Apple fan, it's very easy to listen to this. And me, as an avowed Apple person, it's easy to be like, oh yeah, it's another one of those buffoons, or another one of those sheeple that's just been told to buy this ridiculously expensive product and did, and now this idiot won't shut up about it. And all of those things are mostly true. But I swear to you, go to an Apple store and try it. Even if it's not your cup of tea, it's if you're a nerd and if you're into technology, it's worth the half an hour just to experience what this is like. And they do a pretty good job in 30 minutes of giving you a sample of immersive stuff, a sample of 3D stuff, a sample of what it's like to just try to get work done on this thing, which was not great. But it's worth the 30 minutes just to see and to see the future today.
Well, if my time travel math checks out, I think this episode airs about 2 weeks before Linux Fest Northwest. Goodness, how the conference season is whizzing along in front of us.
Yeah, we might as well take it out with a bang. System 76 and Jupiter Broadcasting are throwing a barbecue. At this point in time, it's very early days. We're just getting it planned. Hopefully, though, it'll be quite the shindig, the shebang, the grill fest. I don't know, Alex, but I hope people can make it. I'll link to a meetup page if you do think you could attend. You're going to be at Linux Fest and you want to join the barbecue.
Shindig ananigans. How about that?
Yeah, I like that. Shindig ananigans. Join the meetup page just so we have an idea of maybe how many burgers and hot dogs we need to buy.
Which means maybe the episode after this, we might be able to record in studio. How weird would that be?
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah, imagine that.
You know, Alex, we probably almost do it more in Airbnbs in person than we do it in the studio in person.
I think so. Yeah. The last time I was in Seattle must have been pre-COVID.
Wow.
I want to say it was the Sprint.
Wow, Alex. I'm glad we're finally fixing that. We should have fixed that sooner. Although there's only so many good months up here, truth be told.
As always, you can go to alex.ktz.me to find all of the various places I'm online. And thank you so much for listening. That was selfhosted.show/121.
Well, I guess to be really obnoxious, we all three are very proud, either Golf R or I'm a GTI owner. And we all immediately bonded over that fact. So... Casey, you have a great way on ATP of explaining why you love the Golf R. Would you mind just once more repeating it for the crowd at home?
Yeah, you know, the Golf R, it's an odd thing. I didn't particularly want to buy that car.
What an endorsement.
Right? Well, just hear me out here. Yeah. I came from a BMW 335, which... I adored for the 10 minutes that it was running. So, I'm being a bit hyperbolic here, but I feel like that thing was constantly in the shop. And every time it crossed the BMW dealer's threshold, it was $1,000+. And this happened regularly. I computed it at one point, and I think we had put something to, or it was between us and some warranty work that BMW ended up paying for. I think in the 6 years we owned that car, something like $16,000-$17,000 worth of repairs went into it. And that was about half of the original purchase price of the car when we bought it used. So Needless to say, I needed something different.
Yeah.
And yeah. My darling wife, whom I adore dearly, and you know, we've been married not quite 20 years, but we're getting there. We're getting close. When I said to her, I think I want to unload the BMW, she first of all said, thank God. And said, okay, I'm so sorry. What are you thinking about? And I said, well, I think I'd like a different German performance car. And she basically looked at me and said, I hope you like being single because that's never freaking happening. However, in a fortuitous turn of events, Dieselgate had just finished. And at this point in the 2018 model year, Volkswagen was offering a 6 year, like 60,000 mile bumper to bumper warranty or something along those lines. And so I said, but honey, hold on. If we buy new, then we get this ridiculous warranty and it'll be great. She said, fine. But to answer your question, why the Golf R? Because, first of all, if you wanted a brand new go-fast three-pedal car sedan, 2018, you really didn't have a lot of options. Audi, I think, had just killed the stick. I couldn't afford like a Porsche or anything like that. And even then, I think the Panamera was automatic only. I'm trying to think what else was modern at the time. Cadillac, CTS-V, but it's unaffordable new and their infotainment system stank. I think Subaru had mostly killed the stick and I'm too old for an STI. I kind of backed myself way into the Golf R because it just was one of the only options that fit.
Right.
Then I had a brief window of time where I fancied myself a car YouTuber and thought of myself as the next Doug DeMuro. And I had a press car. I had a GTI press car and I had a Golf R press car. And that absolutely ruined me. And within a day of taking brief ownership of this or, you know, of borrowing the Golf R, I knew I was going to buy one because the Golf R, to actually answer your question after 45 minutes of rambling, the Golf R does everything pretty well.
Yeah.
It's pretty fast. It's pretty roomy, given that it's, as my family derisively calls it, a nugget car. But it's surprisingly roomy, nevertheless. If you don't have car seats, you can fold the seats down super easy, and it becomes voluminous if you want it to. In the case of the Golf R, it's all-wheel drive. You can get a 6-speed in it, even today, although I think that's stopping in the next model year or two, which is RIP. But, you know, here we are.
If they even keep the ICE in the next car.
Well, that's also true. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it just ticked all the boxes. And it's funny because I'm one of those car nerds that's always looking for the bigger, better deal, right? I always, well, what if, oh, I could get this or I could get that. And honestly, I, other than maybe switching to like an electric car, you know, RIP my left leg, I don't think there's anything I'm really keen on right now. Like the Mark 8 Golf R, my understanding is the infotainment is trash. Like the drivetrain and powertrain, my understanding is phenomenal, but the infotainment is trash, and switchgear even more so is trash from what I've told, I should take my own advice with regard to the Vision Pro, and I should just go test drive a Mark 8 and see what I think. But, but no, it does everything at least reasonably well. And I don't even do things like take it to the track or anything like that, in no small part because I probably money shift and explode the thing. But nevertheless, I just love that it does everything at least passably well. And I would argue does most things pretty darn well.
Pretty good.
And,
yeah.
And that's what works for me. I mean, how did you guys land on them?
Mine was a funny story. I kind of similar in a sense that I rented one. I was traveling and I popped up on Turo and seemed like a good deal. And I'd never, you know what it was, is I'd actually had a really bad impression of a Volkswagen from my wife's Jetta being just riddled with electrical problems, but also the Dieselgate stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know what? I should challenge that assumption. I'll rent this GTI. I've never rented one of these, and I've never driven one before, so I'll get one. And I got it, and it wrecked me. I loved it immediately. So then the next time I traveled, I rented another one, and then the next time I traveled, I bought one. And I was like, I have to have it. So.
That's what happens. Yep. So, Alex, how did you end up in it?
Well, the Golf sat in my garage right now is my, I don't even want to admit this, my seventh Golf.
Oh, my word. across how many continents?
Yeah, two. So my first car when I was 18 was a Ford Fiesta from 1994. You know the shape, it big, boxy, square. I paid a princely sum of £300 for this thing as a student. It was one step above being a rust bucket, but it ran and it did 10,000 miles, and that was all I needed it to do at that point. The next car I bought was a Mark IV T-Reg Golf, which was from 1997, I believe. And it was a 1.6 petrol engine in this thing. And if you know anything about Golfs, you'll know that the Mark IV was a bit of a pig. It was quite heavy. It was quite slow. And with a 1.6 engine in it, it was a miracle it moved at all. Then after that, I had a bit of a break from Golfs for a while. And then when I was just about to move to London, the opportunity to acquire, I actually had one of the Dieselgate Golfs. I nearly forgot one. I had one of the Dieselgate Golfs because I was commuting for an hour plus each way. This is when I got into JB, first of all, Chris, listening to podcasts for an hour, you know, every way on my commute every day. So I replaced that Dieselgate Golf with a GTI. It was a Mark 7. It must have been a 2016 model year, but in Europe, that's a couple of years ahead of the US models because Volkswagen are really annoying like that. And then when I emigrated, obviously I had to sell that one.
Right.
So when I got here, I just bought what I knew. I mean, I looked around because there's actually not that much choice for cars in America. A lot of Europeans don't realize this, but you don't get Seat, which is basically Volkswagen. You don't get Skoda, which is basically Volkswagen.
Peugeot.
You don't get Peugeot. You don't get Renault, Citroën. Like there is a lot missing from the market over here. And even things like models that exist in Europe don't exist over here, like the Audi RS3, for example. If they brought that over here in a hatchback, I would, in a heartbeat, have an RS3 over the Golf R. The 5-pot engine in there, the 2.5-litre five-cylinder engine, the uprated gearbox, the better diff, which is now in the Mark 8 Golf R, by the way. All of those reasons. There's a chap near me, by the way, if you're into YouTube stuff, Humble Mechanic, have you come across him?
I've heard of this, yeah.
He has recently just done what's called a Daza swap on his Ginster Yellow, crashed. It got crashed and he bought it back off the insurance company on his Golf R. So he's just done the Audi RS3 motor swap.
Oh, I bet that's bananas.
Yeah, and he's put like a wide body kit on it and all that kind of crap. So go watch that on YouTube if you find that kind of thing interesting. Charles is a great presenter, first of all, but it's an interesting series nonetheless. So then I bought a red GTI, which Chris rode with me. We went and see Wendell, you know, Wendell on YouTube, you know, the tech guy.
Mm-hmm.
we took a ride in it and went along the tail of the dragon and did all that kind of fun stuff. But this car I bought from CarMax, I'd only been in the country for about a month. So I didn't really quite know what was different about this car, but it turned out that it had been stage two tuned. I knew it was faster than my British one. It had been stage two tuned and it had a sport Unitronic sports exhaust on it. And the drone was dreadful in that thing. But it was fast. It was really, and this is why we were talking in the pre-show about tires. This is how I know if you put Pirelli Pilot Sport 4Ss on a GTI that you'll fix the wheel hop issues. So anyway, I had that car for a year, but when I emigrated, I had to establish a credit score. I mean, I came with no credit at all. So The interest rate I was paying on that car was bananas and kind of insulting. But after a year, this was right at the end of the Mark 7 Golf R run window. So 2019, we're talking here. The six-year warranty and 72,000-mile warranty was still going. So I bought a brand new Golf R.
So it was what, 2019 then?
Yeah, that was the last run. That was the same year they did that kind of like Skittles, like color scheme. I forget, the Spectrum.
Yes, yep, Spectrum. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, turns out they only allocated one per dealer, and Charles, the humble mechanic dude, got the allocation at my dealership, and I was kind of pissed about that because I really wanted an orange one, but anyway.
There's I don't personally care for the color, but there's some, I forget the name of the color, but some like lime green, like in my personal opinion, kind of hideous Viper. Spectrum. So, no, I don't think it was Viper. I think it was something else. Viper is one, to your point, but I think it was something else. I can't remember the name of it, but something starts with a C, I think. Oh, shoot, I can't remember. Anyways, there's one that runs around Richmond that I see every great once in a while. It's funny, too, because when I bought mine, I couldn't find one, and if I could, it was marked up from here to Kingdom to Come. This was in late summer 2018, I believe. I ended up driving the couple of hours up, because it's right up the road, Alex, right? I drove a couple of hours up to Lindsay Volkswagen, which is in Herndon, Virginia, I believe, which is like the home office's nearest dealer.
Yeah.
And so they get ridiculous allocations. And so they had like 5 or 10 of them sitting on the lot or something like that. And I was able to, you know, talk to some kid who I think had just graduated college. That was my salesperson. And I was like, hey, I want to come up in a few days. I will pay you, don't worry about the financing. I'll figure that out. I'll write you a check. And I want, this Lapis Blue Golf R with a 6-speed. And I want it, in a few days. Can we make that happen at a reasonable price? And he was like, yeah, totally. And fast forward, 48 hours and I'm driving away with my brand new 2018 Golf R. It was so easy and so great. And I think it's only because they had ridiculous allocations. Everyone else, I've heard the exact same story you've told. Every other dealer in the country got like one Spectrum and maybe a smattering of Golf R's in general. Meanwhile, you can come up with GTIs by just tripping in a dealer, which isn't to say they're not fancy or special. I'm not trying to like slag on the GTI. It's just that there's zillions of them by comparison.